Sunday, March 6th, 2016 at 8:30 a.m.
So you sent
and
the message
session
last
is how it works
night
over
about
workings
the meeting,
of the World Wide Web Consortium,
what was
W3C.
It? Was it the meeting in Wednesday afternoon? No, it was not the
is
tech meeting. Was it?
Reception?
Which was after?
It was, yes, after.
After
it was at 7 p.m.
Okay, Wednesday, yes, but yeah. It was canceled.
We canceled it.
Because there is a mess. Yeah.
Bob, do you want to bring up the handhelds?
All right, it looks like we have a packed room today. This is the beauty of, I guess, the only session worse than being an afternoon, right after lunch session, is being the first session on a Sunday morning at the ICANN meeting, and being in the basement to boot, so we've got all of this going for us, but that just means it's going to be much more personal experience for each and every one of you. I want to welcome you guys. This is the third installment of our How It Works series. We piloted it 2 meetings ago and then ran a session, these types of sessions in Dublin as well. And so this is our third series of them. And we've got a brand new presentation today. We have Daniel Dardier, and I got that almost right. From the World Wide Web Consortium, and he's going to give an overview of the W3C and talk about it in relation to standard settings. So, Daniel, I'll pass it on to you.
Sure. I'll take this mic. So, hello, good morning. Bonjour, salam. So my name is Daniel Dardaillet. I live in France, where the W3C has a site. I'll explain that. So I'm going to present the consortium and some recent activity as well. So you probably heard of W3C. It's a standard organization specific to the web technology. So to give you some feedback, it was created more than 20 years ago. It's a consortia, so it's not an official de jure standard organization. It's closer to the IETF in that sense. I'll give some detail. It's funded by membership, that is people joining to participate to get more advanced information, but most of the working groups are public anyway. So it's more like sponsorship slash membership. We have a staff, which is, in a sense, a model that is closer to the standard organization that, our usual with what's called a secretariat. But our staff is pretty much technical. It's most of the people that have invented the technology that we work on, whether it's the web, like our director, Tim Earnestly, or, the technology around the web, XML, CSS, metadata, etc. So we have people that work in various places on Earth. And we're focused not just on the web technology, but also on some of the environment, the testing. For instance, we run the validator for HTML and CSS and other markup language on our site, which is a free service that is used by millions of people. We do also a lot of liaising. Yeah, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the standard landscape. Just for the internet, and communication technology, there are dozens of organizations that are specialized in some area of the technology stack. So we have, of course, to make sure that the system works together. So we're responsible for one layer, which is the web, but of course we depend on the well-functioning of the layer below us, the internet. but also we have to pay attention to platforms that are built on top of the web. So as I mentioned, W3C is not incorporated. It's not, it may change in the future. We may decide to become a legal entity, but right now it's a project between different entities that are themselves, of course, legal, and they are usually academic institutions. And we have up today four what we call host sites, that is, you know, academic institutions that provide a salary for staff of W3C and also some steering for the consortium administration. So MIT is the original host site, was created in 94. In 95, we created a European antenna site, which is where I live. I was the director of this antenna for a few years. It's in the south of France at Sophia Antipolis. If you know, that's where Etsy is also in terms of technology. We have a site in Japan as well. And more recently, we opened a site in China, which is growing, at Beiyang University in Beijing. So you might wonder who controls the W3C. It's kind of a difficult question to answer. There are different bodies that are in charge of running W3C, whether it's at the technical level, at the administrative level, or at the strategic level. Sorry, at the strategic level as well. So, one of the most important bodies is called the W3C Management, and it's the set of all the technical leaders of the area that W3C deals with, but also people running the system, communication, you know, international relation. And that body sort of decide on the day-to-day advancement of W3C, but as well on more important and long-term initiative that are then run by an advisory board, which is made of elected by our membership. So we work with the advisory board to come to a consensus for all these matters, and usually when it's important enough, we actually run it through the membership. We ask our advisory committee to not to vote really, because it's more like a consensus system, but to give their opinion, whether or not they would participate in something like that, whether they are opposed to it, whether they don't care. And depending on the resource that we have, the resource that they can provide, we decide to run a new initiative or not. I'm not sure if there's a missing piece of the screen, but anyway, what we produce at W3C, so we also have a technical architecture group, which is on the other side of things. It looks at the overall architecture of the web platform, and from the 50 or 60 working groups that are generating technology, it makes sure that they fit together. And it's also, of course, very much in liaison with other technology groups that are working on internet technology, such as at the ATF, etc. So the tag of W3C is pretty much the architectural board. It decides on whether or not something is good for the web, or it may be a danger or risk for the web architecture. So what we produce is called W3C recommendation. It's the name that we give to our standard. Like ITF gives RFC, we have our own term. This is the final product. It's been tested, implemented usually. It's been also agreed by our membership to bear the name of W3C. You know, we might decide after a whole, work on a technology that it's not worth, you know, becoming a recommendation. It would stay in a different kind of status and people can use it, but it's not a recommendation. We have funny example of that, like the web service architecture document. It's never been a recommendation, even though they were, you know, completely entire system built on top of the web service architecture. That's because, you know, people thought at that time that may not be a time to standardize it, maybe it would evolve. Eventually it stayed like that, and web service became whatever they became, you know. With the cloud coming up, it hasn't really been successful. So this is a map that represents where W3C is present on the planet. We see in red there are the host sites where we have a staff like me. It's probably about 20 people at MIT, 20 in Europe, about 10 in Japan, 10 in China. That's the staff. Of course, this staff, they do not produce the technology. They help the members engineer to produce the technology. So we manage thousands of engineers in hundreds of working groups, but the staff is there to orient, to explain the process, and also to pay attention to the dependency between different working groups. In blue in this picture, you see the offices of W3C. So we have this concept of chapters, which are relay people doing outreach for W3C and also getting input from the local industry whether or not they want to get involved. We have one in Morocco. You can see this dot. It's in Rabat. It's hosted by the, I think it's Mohammedia Engineering School in Rabat. So they, they run workshops. They do translation in Arabic for some of our documents. And you can contact them if you want more information. So a bit on finance. So I mentioned that the membership is what makes most of our revenue. We also get some government grants. Usually they are for research and development, but we try to have them pay for doing standard. But it's not really simple because standard budget usually is reserved for different kind of organization than W3C. But nevertheless, since our standards are pretty much advanced development, we usually get some funding to do some work on that. For instance, most of the accessibility work of W3C, the web accessibility, has been helped by the European Commission from 97, 98 on. We participate in research project with our institution to help people understand what is web accessibility. I'll give you some detail later on. And we get some sponsorship from, either members or for meetings or for initiative in particular. For HTML5, we may get a particular sponsorship to pay for an editor because it's a huge spec. ISOC has also been generous in the past and has helped us going through a tough time. So overall, we have a budget around 10 million euro dollars, whatever. And every year we're basically in the red, which is, we use everything we have, and usually we don't invest because we're a non-for-profit, so we stay at about the same size. We haven't grown much in the past 20 years. So our members, they come from everywhere. You see that there is the U.S. has a big part here. It's evident that there is a lot of web technology giant in the U.S., so you could expect that. But if you look, if you add all the European country together, you'll see that it's about balance. And of course, we have a deficit in countries like China, India, which are huge in terms of internet presence and development, but are not yet fully participating in the Occidental consortia originally. So we try to change that. We rotate our meeting. We make sure that everybody can participate and understand the interest to participate in future web standards. Just a word, if you've been familiar with standardization, it's mostly the same. Ours has some steps that require, whether it's testing or implementation or public review of the specification. Of course, I'm not going to go into the detail of that, but the standardization world is full of patent problems, so we have to pay attention for all these steps, that there is a clear IPR policy for people submitting technology. Usually what happens when we start a new working draft is that there is a set of players that have done already this kind of technology. If you look at HTML5, before we standardize the complete set of markup element, there were, you know, extension to HTML4 in whether it was Netscape or Chrome or Firefox. And so we put all those people in the room together and we have them agree on a common set of semantics for all the elements they want to add. And usually they submit their technology, you know, the extension that they have. So we have to make sure that the submission is not encumbered with patent, because we have made the promise to the community that our standard will be royalty-free. That is, that there's not going to be a problem for implementation for the open source community, for instance, or for just new players that, you know, cannot afford the price of intellectual property for web technology. So this you know, was done by experience. You know, in around 2000, 2001, we had this unfortunate situation where one of the technology we were working on, it was on privacy for web session and things like that. While we were doing the standard, you know, one of the company that was participating came up and say, well, that's fine that you're doing the standard, but we have a patent on that, and so anybody implementing the standard will have to pay something to us. So we realized at that point that we didn't ask systematically to all the players if they had any patent and they would be willing to let them in the patent pool of W3C, in the sense, you know, to have them be used royalty-free. And so we had to, you know, re-engineer our process to make sure that at each step there was a clear way for people to commit. We don't want to take the patent from people. We just want them to make a pledge that they are not going to use this patent to ask for, you know, money to people implementing the web platform. That's our requirement. And even though we have no enforcement, you know, right to chase people that do not do that, we count on the fact that all the industry is playing the same game. So, you know, whether it's Microsoft or Google, they're going to pledge for some of the technology that they have and that they submit to W3C to improve the platform. And in the end, their pledge is such that they promise not to ask for any patent unless someone is asking them for a patent for the same pool of technology. So there is a defensive mechanism. If one player starts to ask for a different kind of regime, then all the other big players that have already, you know, asset in the patent pool can ask this person, only this person, to pay a fee for, you know, whatever, XML, link, something that they must certainly use for free today. So there is this system that has been working for more than 10 years and that works pretty well. So why do we do that? I think the industry has recognized very early on that it was much better to have a share of this big pie here than to have the little pie all for yourself. You know, so it's important that the industry understood that the growth of the market is what is going to make them rich. It's not the technology at a particular layer of the stack. So they want to make sure that the web platform is open so that they can, you know, add other platform on top of it. If you consider Facebook is a platform on top of the web, you have API for Facebook, same way that you have API for the web or API for the TCP or IP level. And so those people, they understand that the freer and the more flexible and the more open is the web platform, the better it is for developer on top of it. So this idea of level playing field is very important for the web platform. So the advantage of membership, since everything is free in the end, and most of the development are public anyway, is that they gain, it's like a club, you know, they gain early access to where the market is going to be in a few months. And that's very important in this area, that they know, even if it's not completely sure, you know, that in 6 months from now there's going to be a new standard on the web platform that is going to allow this kind of innovation. And so they can work on the innovation. They already have worked on the innovation, in fact. They just have to re-engineer it on top of the standard. So the important thing for them is that the new standard is as close as possible at what they have done already. And the challenge for us is to have, you know, two or three big company that have a lot of things, you know, in the web to agree to change their implementation to be a standard. So what we produce is called the Open Web Platform nowadays. So it's HTML plus the technology that are necessary for building web application. So the idea is that the web change from being a web of document, static document that you would go navigate from link to document, to just an operating system where you can build application. It's a network distributed operating system that you can use to write an application with menu bar and, you know, user interaction like a regular application on any computer. So of course the web didn't start as an application platform, so we have to catch up. We have a lot of things that needed to be added to the web. JavaScript provides with a programming language. We didn't pick up JavaScript. It came up, you know, as the winner on the market, and it's being standardized by another organization called ECMA, which is in Geneva. So we haven't really approached the JavaScript standardization. It's as good as it is. You know, it's making improvement. So we've focused on the HTML5 language, which is really now a very powerful language associated with JavaScript, and also on the fact that on the web you want to separate the styling of a page from the content of the page. That's very important for a variety of things. You know, if you can separate the form and the style of a document from its content, you know, then you can repurpose your, you know, you can change it to adapt the user needs. So if you have a mobile, you can change the content presentation to be better, to fit better on the mobile screen. If you're blind, you can change, you know, the content to be a text audio stream, etc. So this idea of separation is, you know, central to the web architecture. And HTML5 is sort of the cornerstone of that, and CSS3 is the language for the style. JavaScript is something else. You have metadata, which is another set of language that helps you describe the content, etc. So the Open Web Platform is the biggest programming platform ever. You know, it has billions of computer running, and you can see, you know, the result of that. Facebook is an application, Google, plus, you know, all the Google Excel sheet, they are application of the Open Web Platform. So you see the Open Web Platform, it's sort of a stack, like an operating system. You get a graphic library, you get network library, multimedia, and everything has to work, of course, in a secure way with authentication, and also in a network way. That is, the data that you get don't come from your disk as an usual application, but they come from different origin on the network. You do HTTP requests to different sites, and you can present them in your same application. But of course, you have to care about the security aspect of that when you get running code coming from different parts of the web on your system. So it's kind of something that takes a lot of time. So around the HTML5, we have organized our activity around what we call Application Foundation. So we have team within W3C and activity within W3C that would be specific to whether it's security or real-time, you know, accessibility, internationalization, things that are normal on any platform. You have, you know, different specialty working for different part of the programming environment. So we have lots of documents. You can visit the site that explain what are the various status of our work. We have this big table that we did a couple of years ago that we're maintaining, where you can see for each of the new or existing technology present on the web, where they are implemented, in which browser, in which server, and how they actually evolve in terms of the standardization process. So I mentioned HTML, CSS. You can see on this slide that there are a lot of technology that we do not alone, but joint with other organization as well. For instance, the HTTP and the URI specification are standard from the IETF, but they, of course, are relevant to the web. They are the interface between the web and the internet. And so we work together with IETF on that. And the thing that are more advanced, like the semantic web technology, usually we have a research project going on with people doing experiment with semantic technology and linked data. I can talk more about linked data, which is sort of the new name for the semantic web. So what we see today is that the web is not just a computer technology, computer scientist technology. Now we don't get too much of the vertical industry participating in the first 10 years, but now we have, whether it's the automotive industry or the health industry or people working in more on the government side, they all want to use the web to the best possible effect. So they come to us and they ask us for extension. Usually what you find is that people are using application on a mobile and they would like to make a website that is a web application that has similar functionality than on the mobile. But the mobile will have access, the mobile native operating system will give you access to a lot of the device characteristics that have never been a topic of interest for the web. You know, whether or not your phone is vibrating or what is the direction of your accelerometer on your phone was not a concern for the HTML of the, you know, the first 10 years of the web, because, you know, the computer didn't have all these features. So now that we want the web to run on the mobile, we have to catch up with all the API that are available to native application. Same for the cars. You know, people, they're doing interface or management orchestration of device on an automobile. They usually use HTML5 because it's much easier for them to develop in their lab, you know, the to emulate the system. So they would like to have an HTML version that help them more secure, more, you know, packaging, because it's very important in a car that you don't give access to the same thing to everybody. So they also come to us and ask us for extension to HTML. So we have this organization of vertical industry now where we try to get input from, whether directly from the industry or from, usually these industry, they have created their own standard organization or consortia, and they have to pretty much liaise with us, and we establish cross membership sometime so that we make sure that we move forward in sync. So the web platform is focused on API, not just on markup, you know, definition, because what programmers want is a programming interface. They want to call function that do something in their program. So most of our specification now are expressed in terms of APIs. We want to support all the media that you can find on the web in a standard way. So we have to look at the, because we want the system to be as free and open as possible, we have to look also at the patent issue that are present in codec, in video format, and there's a lot of that. We want to work on all sorts of screen devices, and that's what the styling, the separation of style with CSS is giving us. More and more people want to communicate between user without going through a server. So we've been working with IETF on direct, you know, communication between different browser, basically different web application. And more, of course, we have to care about privacy and security and all the societal aspect that the web is dealing with on an everyday basis. So I'll go down on some of those in the presentation. So one word on the principle of standardization. A few years ago, three, four years ago, with IETF and IEEE, and I mentioned IAB and ISOC as well, but to mention the three standard organizations that have brought basically the internet to the world. You know, if you consider Wi-Fi and TCP and HTTP, you have you know, what you run on your laptop anywhere you are on the planet. And those technology, they come from organization that were not official standard organization, that are governed by their own principle. So we have our own principle that we tried to present clearly to the rest of the world as the modern way of doing standard, not just internet standard, but we think that our ways of doing standard with consensus, with running code, is a good way for you know, various standards nowadays, not just the computer standards. So, of course, we recognize that it cannot be the anarchy. We have to have due process that explain how people have to participate. We have to be transparent so that everybody can participate. It's obvious because we are, you know, all together, the standard organization, let's say there are a few thousand people, and we have to provide technology for a few billion people. So it's just not possible that we do that alone in an opaque way, you know, without showing everybody that we do all the time. It's the risk of getting wrong and having, you know, just do a technology that is not going to be useful is huge, because there are going to be millions of failure. You know, people trying this technology and not liking it and doing something else. So the waste of resource and of time is just unbearable. So we have to make sure that everything we do is transparent, that people can participate and also review and reorient the technology sometime. So you can look at the Open Stand principle and the people that have also vowed to that on the website. So maybe I'll go now to some specific technology area, but if you have any question on the overall, you know, W3C that I presented, that would be fine now. If you have any question on how we work, how we live, who we are.
Sure.
David Conrad, I guess one of the questions I had is, when you were talking about the finances, you'd indicated that W3C typically operates in the red. One can't operate in the red forever. How is W3C going to deal with
that? Sure. That's why we have a system of host, in fact. That's the advantage of having a system of host. That is, the members or the government contract, they all come to the host. So in Europe, ERSIM, which is the host of W3C in Europe, would sign a contract with the Commission or sign a contract with France Telecom and get money for them. And they have this amount of money, and they pay me and the rest of the staff. And at the end of the year, if we're short because we had to do some important thing, then the host itself, which is a huge organization usually, you know, MIT, they can spare maybe $500,000 just to push us in the green. But
so they're sort of like sponsorships?
Well, yeah, it's more like a backup system. Okay. The host is a backup, you know. In a year where we have more money, that we're a little bit in the green, which unfortunately rarely happen, then they can put some money aside, which is called discretionary fund. And then in the year where we're in the red, they can money back in the system. But it's usually, I mean, it's a fraction of that. You know, we try to be right in the red, in the green. We cannot basically have a capital, so we have to consume everything every year. That's why we're right in the red. You know. So we have this system.
So with OpenStand, it's clear that you probably have a really good working relationship with IETF. And
could you speak slower?
Slowly, yes. That's my biggest problem. So with OpenStand, it sounds like you have a very good working relationship with standards bodies like the IETF and IEEE. But as you said, the web isn't just limited to the computer anymore. Do you find working with other standards bodies like the ITU in particular, do they see the value in cooperating, or is it more of a challenge working with those types of standards bodies?
So speaking for W3C, we've had some good relationship with the de jure standard organization. More than IETF, I would say. It's not that they have a bad relationship with ISO, but they don't have much of a relationship with ISO. We've became a past submitter a few years ago, which means that once our standards are done within W3C, we can have them stamped by ISO to become international standard. They have to go through a ballot and vote by country, and this happened already three times for the web service, for the accessibility, and for more recently for MathML, which is a mathematical markup language. So we have a sort of a contractual agreement with ISO by which we submit our specification for stamping. They have no right to change it, and we maintain the specification after what's called the transposition of standard. So we do that with ISO JTC1 because they are a computer, the computer part of ISO. We don't deal much with ITU because they are a different level. They are more at the network level, so IETF must be dealing more with ITU. We do have liaison with ITU because they are more and more in the application area, so they send us the status of their work because they have W3C as a formal liaison. And usually if we do something in this area, we would point them at what we do already, explaining that there is duplication or not, and that either they should participate or do something that is in an extension of what we do or a complement of what we do. So we haven't run into any crisis for standardization, duplication or anything with the de jure world. We've been more concerned with the fact that our standards are not as recognized as the de jure system by a lot of country. We give it for granted and not everywhere that people can use the W3C or the IETF standard in procurement, for instance. When a government has to buy technology, there are a lot of rules that forbid them to buy technology that are not public and open to all. So usually they can only procure technology that are based on standards that have been recognized by the government. So it's kind of difficult for them. It was difficult for them to say, let's say we want to buy 500 workstations that run HTML because the definition of HTML was not a standard. So anyone can come up and say, well, I fulfill your criteria because I use HTML 3.2 or whatever. There is no clear definition. And it was most important for accessibility where, of course, people with disability, they want to use the government website because they pay their taxes, so they have the right to do that. Plus, sometimes they ask you, the government asks to pay your tax by the web, and if you get to an inaccessible website and you're blind or deaf, you cannot pay your tax. And you can say, I cannot pay my tax. I would like to pay my tax, but I cannot. So the government have been very, paid a lot of attention to making sure the website were accessible. And now the question again was, what is the standard that explain what is a website accessible so that we can buy those authoring tool or user agent? And there was no standard at that time. The only standard was the W3C accessibility guideline. And so what happened for a few years is that individual government, they would take our specification and sort of make their own version of it. The accessibility guideline is pretty much a technology that explain how to write content so that it is accessible if you have an accessible browser, but it is at least accessible on the other side of the pipe. And it's in English. It would explain that if you have an image, then you have to provide a description, textual description for the image, if you have blah, blah, blah. And so people, since it's not very technology-oriented like a TCP or HTTP protocol, they felt that they could change the sentence in the specification. And so we ended up, after a few years, with a lot of variant of the web accessibility guideline. And it's a nightmare for the industry, because the industry has to provide one tool to all the country. They translate it, of course, but it has to be the same technology behind. So our members and the industry, they push so that we take this accessibility guideline and made them an ISO standard. So that's what we did in 2012. So now the accessibility guideline for W3C is called Web Content Accessibility Guideline. It's also ISO 40500. And so government can point at that, and they don't have to change it anymore, and so there is less fragmentation, probably no fragmentation at this point in time, and so everybody's happy. So there is a real use in transposing some of our standard in ISO, just because ISO is a better brand. It's much older, and there are thousands of ISO standards that people are using on a day-to-day basis without problems, so it's less risky for a lot of government to also use ISO. So we're good friends with ISO, and they accept that we do the web. They don't try to take away our expertise, and they're happy to transpose the spec that are very important. That's how we deal with the de jure system nowadays. So not much with ITU, just the basic. They do things for Internet of Things, and we do things for the Web of Things, so we have to look at what they're doing. And they have a complementary action on accessibility as well that we look at, because accessibility is not just a technological problem. There's a lot of education and tooling as well.
Any other questions from the floor here? Let me do a quick check on our online. In the meantime, I have a question. So in my simple understanding is that the IETF is currently the caretaker of the HTTP protocol, and the web of
web consortia.
Web consortia, thank you, is everything beyond that, or many things beyond that. What's the line between that? So something like RTC web, which is, I think, being developed, co-developed.
Both, yeah.
What determines where what lies within IETF, and what determines what lies within W3C?
So I mentioned HTTP and URI that are really the interface technology that are done at the IETF with W3C heavy participation. So historically, you have to understand that the W3C was created as an IETF application area for HTML in probably 1991, something like that. For a couple of years, it stayed as an HTML application area of IETF. And then the industry decided that the web was going to be too big for an application area of the IETF, and they decided to create a consortium on the model of the X-Window consortium. I'm not sure how many people remember the X-Window consortium, but it was a consortium, mostly American, dealing with a graphical UI on Unix. You know, at that time, the war was Windows, Unix, and Unix didn't have a common platform for doing graphics. It was a problem, so the X-Window system was created, and it's still there. You know, it's on Linux now, but the X-Window consortium has done its job, basically. But they had a model of consortia which was different than IETF, giving more flexibility in terms of having a staff that would be completely neutral, not employed by the member of the W3C. So it was the X consortium model, the X window consortium model. I can stay, if there are other reasons, but there was the idea. So, but for that reason only, HTTP and URI, which were at IETF, they stayed at IETF, and we didn't take them because Tim Berners-Lee thought that it was going fine, and it was not something that would explode in terms of the technology stack. Whether for the web, we started with HTML and CSS, and now we have 300 specification that are also on top of HTTP and URI. So now, when we have a new technology that requires new protocols, that usually requires also an expertise at the TCP, IP, UDP level, then what we've done recently for the RTC web, RTC is real-time communication web, which is communication between browser, between host, and we have splitted the sort of the work between the protocol level work done in an IETF group and the API, sort of the corresponding API in HTML in the web platform done at W3C, with of course all the requirement that they are the same. So that's, we work along those lines. And when we have technology that are dependent on the network layer, then we go with IETF to do a joint group usually. And we have regular coordination, technical coordination with IETF.
Any other questions for right now?
What time is it?
It is 9:20. Do you have more presentation, or was that?
Yeah.
Keep going. You've got time.
Specific area. So I'll go over the web accessibility because it's the one that I know the best. I started this activity in 97. Well, we'll talk about internationalization because it's of interest to ICANN, I suppose. You know, all the issue is IDN and linguistic, security policy, and also so I'll talk about some new initiatives that are running at W3C. So what is web accessibility? So you see in this picture, you have that's the basic sort of architecture of the work that we do on web accessibility. The most important thing is the content. The content that you find on a website, that has to be accessible. If that is not accessible, there is not much you can do. So most of our work at the beginning went on defining what is accessible content. What does it mean to be accessible? What does it mean to create accessible content? And so it's a difficult topic because accessibility and usability are different things that people usually confound and mix together. So accessibility is really about improving the experience of the user regardless of their, you know, the capacity that they have of accessing a particular media stream. So it usually resolves into serializing, being able to serialize the content so that it can be presented in one dimension instead of two or three. So if you consider this web page, for instance, this page, you know, it's, well, it's actually a PowerPoint, but I have the same thing in HTML. But anyway, you see that there is a logo, a title, there is a bullet list, there is a graphic that is quite semantic loaded. You know, it explains a lot of things. And so all that in the content, it has to be expressed the same way that I just express it. You know, there is the title, that's the value of the title, there is a bullet list that explains blah, 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 etc. Once you have described that in HTML, once, for instance, the navigation structure has been described in HTML, if the graphics here can be summarized into a sentence, you have entered that sentence, then you know, you're saved. You know, maybe the user agent, the browser that you're going to use, is not going to be able to read everything, but you can update or use a proxy to help you, and that's fine. And if you're using an authoring tool like a Dreamweaver or anything to create content, you have to make sure that the tool you're using is going to let you add the data, the accessible data that is missing. So, you know, the content is the most important thing. And for people that are creating new languages, not just using HTML, but, you know, at the beginning of the web, it was clear that HTML was not going to be the language for everything. You know, if you want to express an invoice on the web, you're not going to use HTML. You could, but it would be a poor use of semantics. If you want to describe an invoice on the web, you create your own language or you use one that exists already that says, what is the value of the invoice, the name, the date? You have your own element that give you the semantics of an invoice. Same thing if you want to describe a plane or anything that can be described electronically. We have a language called XML that you can use to create other language. XML is a meta language. It's a grammar that lets you create HTML-like languages. So for people that are creating new language, then we have to explain to them that if they want to include graphics or multimedia or whatever in their language, they have also to provide the hooks for the author to describe the media in some textual form. So accessibility is for the content in HTML, it's for the content in any language that is used using XML, and it's also for the user agent that is the program that people are going to use to access this data. You have to explain to both sides that, you know, if the author has put this kind of information in the content, then your browser should let the user select that information instead of using the image. So it's a system with an authoring tool, user agent, and content that have to work together all the time. Of course, you have added, you know, what's called assistive technology that people are using. If you're blind and you're using a web browser, you're going to have either a braille, electronic braille display that convert text into braille, or you have to, most of the people now, they will use audio output. And audio input as well is used for accessibility, but not just for accessibility. The important thing for accessibility is that everything we do for people with disability is used 90% of the time for people without disability. That's the same deal for the curb cut, you know, the sidewalk, when they have a cut on the sidewalk for people with wheelchair. If you count how many people in wheelchair passes by this side, you know, cut, versus the number of people with luggage or with a woman carrying a baby or anything that has wheels, you know, then you'll find that the real use of the side cut is not for the disability people, it's for everybody else. They use it all the time. And it's the same on the web. If you have a page that is accessible, it means that you can, you know, re-display it in a different environment that is better for you, whether or not you're disabled or we have an accessibility problem. So if you're in a noisy environment, you really want to see the subtitle of the video that you're looking, because otherwise you're not going to understand anything. So you're deaf. Basically, you're deaf. In a noisy environment, whether you're outside working or not, you don't have your ear to use. So we try to convey that message, that if website manager, they take care of accessibility, they're going to help everybody with a better design, simpler design, better navigation, less bandwidth. You know, if your images are described in a way that provide the same functionality, then people can decide not to download the image, period. You know, the image is going to stay on the server. You don't have to download it. You just download the piece of text that is functional for the image. So the idea with accessibility, that is always the degradation, of course. We're not going to show a map of France and asking a blind user to select a point on the map to say where they want to book an hotel. So they are not going to see the two-dimension map. But they're going to see a list of all the town, the big town in France, which is an alternative version of the map, basically. The map is what? It's a list of town with coordinate, and you can provide that with another list. There's going to be a degradation, but the function of the system, which is to have you select a town, is going to be the same in both cases. So that's the idea, that there has to be some kind of degradation, but it has to be functional in the end. So I mentioned that the bulk of the work here has been transposed into an ISO standard. So that, you know, there was a real reason for avoiding fragmentation of this particular standard. But for the others, like web service, it was also a fragmentation reason, but it was a different one. So where are we in accessibility nowadays? The main guideline, the WCAG 2, Web Content Accessibility Guideline 2.0, is pretty much stable. It's being now reused not just on the web for any kind of electronic conversation and communication. The other two guidelines that explain how to generate page that are compliant or to read page that are compliant are less successful because basically they are not protocol level. They concern either the authoring only or the reading only. So they are good to have, but people can live without them. They are not a network protocol guideline. What else can I say on web accessibility? I mentioned that this was an area that was heavily funded by government grant. And the reason was clear that they needed a standard that was stable so that they could use it in their own procurement. internationalization. So we've had also this activity forever. You know, when the web started, like the internet, it was mostly ASCII. You know, that's the way it was in the 80s and the 90s. And then one of the reasons it was ASCII was there was no Unicode at that time. You have to understand that Unicode, which is the standard that allows us on the web to be, you know, to work in many languages, didn't exist before the web. It was created basically at the same time as the web. Because, you know, before Unicode, every country had their own encoding for their own character. So if you wanted to support something, like write in Arabic or in Chinese, you had to pay attention to the encoding of this country. And, you know, countries have different encoding for the same language most of the time. So Unicode really gave a level playing field for the internationalization. But it was not enough. Of course, it only defined the character. And on the web, you have more than the character to deal with. You had a lot of things that are related to the presentation of the data. For instance, you look at a date. It's not enough just to translate the month, you know, from March to mars in France. You have, in French, the month and the day are reversed, in fact. When you say the date of today is 0603, right? Well, 0603 or 0306. So you have to know that on the web, you know. So you have a lot of added complexity for internationalization. You know, the direction of writing, of course, right to left to right, vertical, the date, the check mark, you know, some countries have different check marks. So everything that we consider on the web has to pay attention to internationalization. Privacy and security. It's been you know, a problem forever as well, that we created the web without much security in mind, and now we have to care for security and privacy everywhere. So you know, we work closely with other organizations on that. We don't control the entire stack of the secure, you know, secure network, of course, but on the web we can help with some of the aspects. Privacy is mostly important when you dialogue with a web server, and that the web server is taking personal data out of you, either because you're giving it away, you're filling up forms, or just the server knows where you're clicking because it's you're clicking on its page. So you can track the user one way or the other, many ways, in fact. So we've decided to create a technology that allow a client, a browser, and a server to negotiate the kind of privacy information that can go back and forth between the two. And nowadays we're working on web authentication to make sure that, you know, people try to avoid using password but use a more secure technology. We've been working with other consortium that have been working on privacy, security, authentication outside of the web. Of course, you know, in the finance, in the industry, there's a lot of that when you use a credit card. So we have to unify all that using the web. Let's see, what else? There are several groups that you can look at. Wendy Selzer, with the other contact for the tag on at ICANN, is in charge of this activity, so you can talk to her at any time. I want to give you a word on policy. Originally, W3C is a technical consortium. We don't deal much with politics, but as it matter, when I first started working at W3C in 96, the first thing I had to do was to deal with something called PIX, Platform for Internet Content Selection. So at that time, in 95, the U.S. government wanted to pass legislation that would forbid indecent content on the internet. That was the term, indecent content. And then, you know, the entire industry say, you know, what is indecent? What does it mean? And so we realized that there is no international legislation on what is indecent, or what is nudity, or what is sexual abuse, what is pedophilia. You know, if you look at you know, pedophilia. You see that in some country, the age of sexual consent is completely different. It would be 13, 16, 21. Also, the display of pedophilia is completely different. In some country, it's completely forbidden to even draw comics that display children and adults together. In some other country, it's okay to make montage of photo. If nobody was hurt, it's okay. So the legislation, the social legislation, is non-existent. There is no international legislation for what is, you know, a child abuse and things like that. So how do we do that on the web? How do we improve the situation? So the idea was to create metadata, a metadata language that would let any owner, provider of content describe the content in objective term. So nudity, for instance, you take nudity, frontal nudity is very objective, that you see the front, you know, the breast of a woman or whatnot. So that's an objective criteria, and someone can say that you can see, you know, front nudity on this photo. And then on the receiver end, whether it's an organization, a country, or a family, they can decide that everything that has frontal nudity, it's a check mark. They don't want to see it, or the children should not see it. So by using metadata, you had an indirection. You let the content provider or someone describe the data along various axes. So it can be gambling, nudity, sexual, violence. There is a lot of objective criteria that have been worked on in various societies, so you have to unify a bit that. And then it's a question of encoding that and letting each party do the filtering that they want. So it's both filtering and censorship, you could say. You know, once you have the semantic described in the content, you can do filtering for good. You can say that your employee should not see gambling site during the work hour, which sounds okay, I would say, you know, as a policy. But you could also say that everything that has frontal nudity should be banned from the country. You know, if you have access to all the ISP coming into your country and all the content and the web, then you can do that. So between filtering for harmful content and censorship, there's a fine line. You know, what we do with this kind of semantic web technology, we provide a technology. It's a neutral technology, and if it's used for good, it's good. If it's used for bad, it's bad. You know, that's the only thing we can say. So anyway, that was the first sort of contact we had with legislation, because we had to explain to legislators that they could not just forbid indecent content on the internet, because there is no such thing as a definition of indecent content. Then I mentioned accessibility, which was also one of the strong reason for why we've been, you know, closer to government policymaker, because they really needed an accessibility standard to implement their policy. You know, they have policy that says we have to consider, you know, equal treatment for accessibility of disabled user and not disabled user, and they want to implement this policy and they can. So they had to have this standard, and they help us producing one, which is now an ISO standard, which is good. So internet governance has been also very active for W3C, because we're doing a standard, and standards are part of internet governance. If you have a standard, then you have a way of implementing usually a governance policy. So we've been involved in like the open standard fight, you know, in the 2005, there was a lot of fight around the patent and around what was an open standard. You had, if you remember, you had the OOXML versus the ODL fight for open office. All that was not really W3C's problem. It was more on the office side. But nevertheless, we were involved into the open standard, royalty-free policy matter as well. So nowadays, there's a lot of debate on privacy, on security, on things that are more high level, like a right to be forgotten. You know, right to be forgotten is something that popped up a few years ago from Europe, where, you know, it's considered, in France in particular, it's considered as a right for someone to remove the trace of what they say in the past, providing they are not a public person and there is no public interest in having this data being available. So if a few years from now I said something that I regret, then in France I can force the person hosting this data to remove it completely from the web. Well, completely from their site. I mean, they may have been copies and everything, but it's a one-by-one aspect. So we have legislation that impacts on some of the principle that we have on the web, which are that once you put something on the web, it has to stay there forever. We have this very solid notion of permanence on the web. You know, we want to make sure that the links are going to be around in 10 years from now. And if you start doing right to be forgotten on a massive scale, then most of the links are going to be 4-4. You know, it's never going to happen, but that's the idea. There's a lot of discussion has been all the time about deep linking. I can mention a bit that deep linking is something that the policymaker created. There's no such thing as deep linking on the web. Every link is a deep link on the web. But the notion of homepage or portal, which have no technical equivalent. I mean, there's nothing. A homepage is just a link, right? It can be w3.org/homepage, or it can be w3.org, or it can be anything else. So there's no dependency between the syntax of the URL and the fact that it's a homepage or a portal or something that you want people to go through. So website content provider, they would like people to go through their homepage and then to go through the article below their homepage. But once they provide the article URL, then anyone can make a link to this URL directly. So you have a conflict between content provider that wants to control the way people navigate and the web, which does not forbid you to navigate once you have the URL. Of course, you have access control, that's fine, but hidden by obscurity is bad, you know, on the web. It doesn't work. Once you have the URL, everybody has it. You're just a link away from being completely public. So, unfortunately, there are some countries in Europe where the legislation on deep linking has been successful. That is, people can go to the court and say, this person has made a link to my internal website, although I say on the homepage that you cannot do that. And some people are completely afraid by that because you have to read everywhere before making a link to a page that you know, and that's not good. What else on policy? Let's see. We're about to start a policy technology working group, interest group, to discuss some of these items because the internet governance is now very present in our agenda. Our members care about what are we going to say about such topic. Okay, so before I conclude, maybe you have a question on this technology or other technology I didn't mention.
We have a question in the back.
Thank you. When you were describing the content filtering...
Could you close the door? Because I have a hearing problem. Thanks. I'm over here.
When you were discussing the content filtering solution, is that the same thing as Powder, or is that something different? Because I'm aware of Powder.
Yeah, Powder is the new version of PIX. PIX was sort of the initiator project. It was not XML. It was just a Lisp syntax that you attach to a page that would give you a rating for basically four criteria, nudity, violence, sexual content, and I don't remember the other one. So it was very limited with a particular area. And Powder is more generic. You can attach any kind of vocabulary, any kind of semantics, and it uses a better format, which is RDF, which is a semantic web format. So a semantic web format Just to give you a short explanation, XML is a... XML is like HTML, it's a hierarchical format. So everything is in a document, everything is a child of something. You have a root element, and then you have a section with bullet in it, etc. RDF, which is Resource Description Framework, is a semantic web format. It's a graph-oriented format. You don't have a hierarchical relation. You have a triplet. You say something is something, or something, has a particular property. So you say Daniel, name is Dardaye. So this graphic, this graph-oriented syntax lets you do, much more powerful thing. You can say that this page has this rating along this axis, for instance, nudity. But you can further say that this statement, that this page has this rating along this axis, is vowed by this organization. You can say that the French government guaranteed that this page has this value. And you can pile, you can pile up an assertion about something that gives a meaning, the quality of the thing. So it's not just about saying that something belongs to this class, but you can really define the semantic of something and actually say something about this statement. So Powder is a language to describe this thing using the semantic web language. So it's more powerful. It's sort of the next generation of PIX in that sense.
And does W3C, do you track and monitor the usage of your standards?
We don't really do that. We have a validator, as I say, that would help people providing content to validate the syntax of their content online, or they can download the validator and do all kinds of things. But we don't crawl the web like Google would do and search for valid page. We don't do that. We don't even check that our members' page are valid. They may have reason not to be valid, and that's not our problem, basically. We're not a policy, a police, It's all voluntary standard. It's like the root of the internet, Anyone can point to their own root, but not a lot of people do because they lose the interest of being equal or participating in the same thing. So it's same for the web. If people start doing extension to HTML, they have to realize that it may work with one particular browser that maybe ask them to do the extension, but it won't work for most of the people, so it's a challenge. And most of the time, people would do a programming trick, see what browser is coming in, and adapt there, which is not very good as well. Okay?
Any other questions? No? Do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah. So let's see what's important on this slide. Not much. The risky competition fact. We take for granted that the web is good and it's going to be there open for all. But as I said, there is you may have seen that. When you go to a website today, you're asked to choose between downloading an application, a native application on your mobile, or using the website. And I would say that there is a tendency of improvement, but if you go to the website, you don't get the same user experience that if you download the application. There are many reasons for that. The website has to be connected for one thing. You cannot use it sometime offline. And since your mobile can do some of the adaptation itself, you can increase the size of the screen pretty much independently of the content, just in zooming in. People usually they let the sort of the desktop website run on the mobile, which is not ideal because the user experience is bad and people would prefer to download the app. Also, I mentioned the native app on a mobile has access to much more API to do nice things like direction, location. So we're adding that to the web platform, and more or less, we think it's going to stabilize. I mean, there is a limit to the sort of new hardware capability you can add to a mobile. It's at some point you maybe you'll have a mobile that, you know, gets the temperature and things like that, which is not common today. But with the accelerometer, the direction, I mean, the geolocation, we think what we're going to converge, and the web API, set of API to do web application on mobile is going to be similar to what you get on a native platform. So once we reach that point, we think that most of the programmers will realize the value of doing a web app instead of a native app on a mobile, because you don't have to reprogram it for the iPhone or for the version of Android that comes in up, or BlackBerry, anything. If you do a web page and it works well as a mobile application, then that's the only thing you have to do, and usually it would work on all the device. So that's a lot of work to catch up with the new OS, that, you know, capability. But as I said, we think that we're pretty much close to filling the gap. I mentioned that you know, we have this horizontal activity at W3C, like security, accessibility, internationalization, device independence, that everybody cares about. You know, everybody wants that their particular technology is accessible, internationalizable, and et cetera. And the work to make all the review of the specification is something that not a lot of people are ready to pay for. Usually, if you look at the company, they would go into one direction, provide a new technology that is very nice, that they would like to make a standard of it. But in the end, they haven't thought about all these horizontal constraints, such as accessibility, language support, security, privacy. So these are the things that we think should be funded by, you know, some kind of organization to do the common good for all these platforms. So in as much as the automotive industry can pay for the extension to HTML to support HTML in their car system, things that are horizontal in nature are always forgotten by even by the government nowadays. Government wants some to fund things that are in innovation, and these are not innovation. They are just things that you have to do. So that's one of the message. Okay, thanks.
Great. Well, thank you, Daniel. I appreciate you coming today. A little bit of housekeeping. We passed out a piece of paper. We are constantly looking to how to do this better, so we would appreciate any feedback you have. If you have any ideas of what types of sessions you would be interested in the future, please write those down. We take your feedback seriously, and we'd like to get as much as we can. We are having a repeat of this, too. If you have colleagues, friends, enemies who might get some value out of learning more about the W3C or any of the other sessions that will be happening today, please tell them, because we're doing a repeat of this entire day tomorrow, too. So anyone who might be interested who didn't hear about us, please, you know, tell them and hope that they come tomorrow. We will also have these slides up on the website in the agenda. They'll be up within the next couple of days, and they will be there in the archives forever and ever, and long, you know, as long as the internet lives, so will these slides. So with that, Daniel, thank you very much, and we'll see you tomorrow. And our next session here is at 10:30. There's a coffee break right now, and at 10:30 we'll have Alain Durand talking about internet networking. So we hope to see you guys then as well. Thanks.